Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a tense vigil in the Gulf of Mexico today as everyone watches the well and the deep ocean floor around the well. Last week, cap on, oil stopped. This week, it's holding. But is it leaking, seeping somewhere else? And what about the damage already done? Today, we'll look at the latest on the well and first totals of the environmental impact of all that oil. This hour on Point, the cap, the questions, and the toll on the Gulf. You can join the conversation. Are you hopeful that the worst of the spill is past? Will we see a healthy Gulf in your lifetime? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Everybody celebrating last week or wanting to celebrate, but lots of cautions out there about what may be coming. Tape here from all corners in this vigil here on Friday is a Louisiana oysterman, Stefan LaFrance, saying he's skeptical that the cap would really stop the flow of oil.
Somebody said if they stopped this leak, it was going to leak in two more places. I don't think they stopped this leak.
Skepticism after nearly 3 months of that oil essentially just running. On Friday, Thad Allen, the National Incident Commander for the BP oil spill, the government's top official on this, sounded a note of concern about the state of the well, pointing out that pressure readings did not rule out possible oil leakage.
Could be the pressure is lower because we have depleted the reservoir based on the amount of oil that's been produced and released into the environment. Alternatively, it could mean that there was a loss of product someplace in the well itself because of well integrity.
BP doesn't want to see that. Nobody does. In a media conference over the phone yesterday, BP's chief operating officer, Doug Suttles, said they would proceed carefully and work closely with the government to determine whether or not to keep the cap closed on the well.
At this point, what we do is regularly review all of the results, including the pressure data, with the government. And, of course, if we saw indications of a problem, at that point, we'd have to determine with them whether it was appropriate to reinitiate flow.
Today, some tension between the government and BP over whether or not to keep that cap closed and perhaps risk seepage elsewhere. All kinds of speculation about why that may be the case. Here's an interview from the Associated Press yesterday. Jackie Savitz, senior scientist with the conservation group Oceana, saying that she's not surprised BP wants to keep the containment cap on.
BP will be fined based on the amount of oil that they're releasing. And so it's in their interest to release less oil, if at all possible. But, you know, I think what we've seen is the kinds of shortcuts that BP likes to take are what got us into this mess in the first place, and we need to learn from that.
So hope is on the table. The cap is on. The oil is stopped for the moment, but all kinds of questions on the table as well. With us first today from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is Daryl Burgoyne. He's director of Louisiana State University's Petroleum Engineering Laboratory. Daryl Burgoyne, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, Tom, I'm glad to be of help.
Help us understand, if you would, what seems right now like some tension between the government and BP over whether or not to keep this oil bottled up. What's the source of that tension, Professor Burgoyne?
I don't know that there's necessarily tension. There's an abundance of caution that they actually understand what's happening. Both BP and the Coast Guard want to have full understanding. The pressure building and holding like it has is not indicating a leak, and then they're just having to run down these anomalies. Could they be natural seeps and not necessarily indicate a leak? They're just trying to nail that down.
Now, the pressure that everybody was ideally looking for was what? Higher, up around 7,000, 9,000 pounds per square inch, I guess. Instead, it's 6,700 or so, or was, indicating that there may be something going on somewhere else. Like what?
The interpretation would have been a lot simpler if they had had the higher pressures, because in that case there wouldn't have been any depletion to confuse the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's at the 6,700 PSI and building like they would expect if they had shut in on a reservoir, that tends to indicate that there's not a leak. But since it's not as high, there could have been a pre-existing leak that they shut in on. They could, you know, be preventing them to get as high as they would have expected if there was no depletion. So they're really concerned about the case. Oh, there's less depletion than is indicated, and there was some pre-existing leak that couldn't be detected during the shut-in process.
Everybody's worst nightmare is that it would erupt somewhere else, between the wellhead and the cap or on the sea floor. What are the odds of that seem to be, Darrell Burgoyne?
I would say the odds are pretty low because the well was designed to handle those pressures. That said, I don't see that it's necessarily a worst-case scenario. You know, the worst-case scenario has been what we experienced back when there was no cap, no collection.
Mm-hmm.
Even if there is a leak, the rate should be considerably less than was experienced with that uncontrolled flow.
Now, the government scientists were saying late yesterday that they're worried about a seep and the possible detection of methane in the area of the well. We heard on the news there at the top of the hour, maybe as much as 2 miles away. Could that be related? Do they have sniffers or submarines down there looking all over in a radius around the well? How are they keeping an eye out for potential seepage?
You know, to detect very small seeps, the only method available would be a visual kind of survey with ROVs. 2 miles away sounds like a considerable distance. That's the first I've heard it was that far away. It's entirely likely that it's a natural seep. You know, this is an oil and gas producing area,
mm-hmm.
and oil moves through the subsurface over geologic time. It could even be oil from the same source as the blowout reservoir. But if they can catch a sample, they can do a chemical analysis and determine if it's been weathered like would be expected for a natural seep.
Thad Allen, the Coast Guard Admiral who's in charge for the government's been kind of tough-toned on this, Darrell, in the last 24 hours. He said the government would just would okay this so-called integrity test, that is, keeping the cap on and closed for another 24 hours. The BP's talking about sounds like more like just keeping it on, period. It seems as though the government didn't want to risk, you know, blowing something out or getting seepage elsewhere and was ready to go, maybe ready to go back to letting it flow and collecting it rather than risking something worse. What do you think of that?
Well, I think the government's taken a line that, okay, BP proved to us, to our satisfaction, even a rigorous abundance of caution level of satisfaction, that the action, you know, keeping it shut in is the correct course, and do it on a very regular basis. You know, BP's looking kind of towards the future. I guess they get plenty of reporters asking them questions. Well, what's the most likely scenario?
Mm-hmm.
The most likely scenario, in my opinion right now, is that they will keep it shut in. That's what's best for the environment. And rightly so, the Coast Guard's saying, okay, prove to us that it is the right course of action on essentially hour-by-hour, day-by-day basis.
Right. I guess the whole country wanting to hear that and see that. I mean, there's skepticism out there, and I wonder what you think of it. And also, if you can explain, you know, one line of skepticism is that if they reopen, then they could get a precise measure of the volume of oil that is leaking and therefore perhaps has been leaked. There's issues of liability for BP around how much oil is in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, as a petroleum engineer, do you have that level of skepticism of BP that they might not want to reopen it, even if there's some risk, because they don't want a carefully calibrated number on the spillage and their liability?
Well, I think from an engineering standpoint, they're very justified in trying to keep it closed, or actually from an environmental standpoint, and I would think mm-hmm. the government would agree, in order to bring it back on production, there might be, I think BP indicated, as much as 3 days worth of release, you know, forcing the environment
right.
to sustain that kind of
that much more.
Impact
mm-hmm.
for a little bit more data seems... I mean, that's a decision for the Coast Guard to make, but if the data is justified and BP's to, you know, told we need that information, I guess they could do it. But would it be what's best for the environment? I think that's for the Coast Guard to decide.
Everybody watching very closely, from marine biologists to stock market analysts. Question for you from Tony in Boston. Tony, you're on with Professor Darrell Burgoyne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. if this cap actually has valves on it, then why can't we attach some pipes or ductworks to these valves and have them go up to a ship up above and let it go there? Then you've got zero back pressure on the head, which means that maybe there could be a flotilla of ships up there for a period of time. That's one question. And the other question is that if we know what the pressure is, that is a 7,000 psi or 70,000
nearly
psi?
Seven.
Mm-hmm. Yep, 7,000. So, and we know the diameter of the pipe. You should be able to get the flow rate of there.
Tony, thanks for your call. Our time is short before the break, but Daryl, what about just, you know, hooking up to that cap right now? Is that not possible, and therefore take away the risk of it blowing out somewhere else?
It's totally possible. They have some ships up there that have a fixed amount of capacity. They can't handle all the oil necessary to drop it yet. I mean, they're adding some ships and adding some capture capacity.
But why 3 days of loose oil if they open it up again? Why not just hook a garden hose on, you know, or whatever it is? Because
they have to ramp up those operations in a safe manner. You can't just turn them on. They have to be ramped up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure the details why they would have to let it totally go. Perhaps they wouldn't. But apparently both the Coast Guard and BP agree that they would have to release oil to resume capture operations.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the oil cap and maybe seepage drama in the Gulf of Mexico. And capped or not now, the biological fate of the Gulf and what comeback we can hope for. Daryl Burgoyne is with us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He is director of Louisiana State University's Petroleum Engineering Laboratory, and we've got him for a couple more minutes for your questions on the engineering front. Adam in Northampton, Massachusetts. Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have sort of one question in two parts.
Mm-hmm.
One is, I think that we've reached the end of easy-to-get oil, so land-based wells in Texas. And given that situation, we're also allowing companies like BP to take a public risk, oil gushing out into the Gulf, for private profit. And we have those two things combined. I think that future problems like this are not only inevitable, but will be increasingly common.
Adam, let me take that to Daryl Burgoyne for the Louisiana perspective. Daryl, how do you look at it? We're all looking at the public risk to the entire Gulf of Mexico here that's being played out right now. Of course, BP has made private profit off that. What do you see coming in the future? Adam's kind of suggesting let's keep it on land where it can't travel all over a sea. As an engineer, how do you think about that instinct?
I haven't really contemplated the public risk versus economic benefit question too heavily. I just know that there's a lot of economic benefit to Louisiana and the nation as a whole being able to produce oil and gas resources here locally until some alternative becomes viable. Those are some big fields out there that are very economic to produce. If we can find a way to do it and make the public risk acceptable, it seems like there's a big economic driver to do that.
What about that? We're going to hear in a moment about how many years it may take for this to recover. I guess that's the cost, and whether it can all even recover. What do you think the odds are of being able to do this safely? I mean, they've got to be like just incredibly low to justify something that the whole environment pays for years, don't they?
Yes, there's lots of activities that we do as a society, as mankind, that impact the environment, and we minimize the risk of those endeavors. Oil and gas is one of them that has to abide by that also. I'm really most interested in what the root cause of this blowout was. Is it something that indicates a fundamental misunderstanding of the engineering principles, which I think is pretty unlikely, or is it something that just indicates that we need to watch carefully or do something differently? You know, maybe perhaps it was just something with that particular rig that needs to be watched out for.
More questions on the engineering front. Mark in Niagara Falls, New York. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I was just wondering, what is the water pressure in pounds per square inch down there? Does that contain the oil? It's like nearly a mile underwater, and I know they have to build like submarines and bathysculpts or bathyspheres or whatever they call them to withstand like enormous pressure. Where's equilibrium? Where is the water pressure equal to the...
Why doesn't it hold it? I mean, we've seen that it doesn't. I see a note here, Mark, that you work in a high-pressure steam plant, so this is kind of your neck of the woods.
Well, I used to, but I was just like a guy with a shovel there, but it was like 1,200 pounds per square inch, and it was enough to drive a turbine, superheated steam, if I remember correctly.
Right. So with that, Daryl, what about the pressure down there? It does not seem to have done much of anything to contain the oil without a cap on. We saw the video of that.
The pressure at the generated by the seawater column is about 2,300 psi, and right now it looks like the reservoir at that same depth can put out about 67 to 6,800 psi.
Mm-hmm.
So that differential is what causes it to flow, and the cap is what's providing the additional pressure necessary to stop it from flowing.
Pounds per square inch, but not enough, and even at that high deep sea level to overcome the pressure of that oil coming up. Pat, in Elizabethtown, Kentucky, you're on with Daryl Burgoyne of Louisiana State.
Just a simple question I wanted to ask the LSU professor if he's getting money from BP. I read an article last week that lots of LSU professors are getting pay from BP, and if that would confuse the situation.
Pat, thanks for your call. I should make clear, Daryl Burgoyne is director of Louisiana State's Petroleum Engineering Laboratory, but what about it? Is there a financial relationship of any kind, Daryl?
You know, I have no consulting relationship. This laboratory and you know, the Department of Petroleum Engineering has done research work for BP in the past. There's nothing active right now. And of the consulting work that I'm aware of among our faculty, some of it's even for the government in the investigation, and the other faculty are involved in like this determination of how much was being how much oil was being mm-hmm. released in the environment and things like that.
Mm-hmm. People's antenna really up right now. I know we've got to let you go. What's your best guess? Do you think we're over the hump here? Do you think we're on our way to a relief well and an end to this gushing anyway?
I think we're well over the hump. I mean, I'd be hesitant to say that absolutely just because I'm a human being, I can be wrong. But when it shut in and held, you know, that's really a good sign. And like I said, the well's designed to hold that pressure. So I would say if we're looking for the most likely scenario is that we're not going to let any more oil hit the Gulf.
Let's hope not. Daryl Burgoyne, director of Louisiana State University's Petroleum Engineering Laboratory, joining us from Baton Rouge. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Here's President Obama speaking to the press in the Rose Garden on Friday, cautiously optimistic about the cap over the BP well in the Gulf.
The new cap is good news. Either we will be able to use it to stop the flow, or we will be able to use it to capture almost all of the oil until the relief well is done. But we're not going to know for certain which approach makes sense until additional data is in.
And millions of oil already spilled into the Gulf, and lots of people working and thinking right now about what that means for the environment there. On Saturday, commercial and charter fisherman Alan Sessom was asked what he thought of the Gulf's prospects for recovery.
It depends on how bad that oil messes everything up. If it upsets the ecology out there, then that could be the Dead Sea.
Could be the Dead Sea. We hope not. Joining us right now from Big Spring, Texas, Larry McKinney is here. He's director of the Heart Research Institute for Gulf of Mexico Studies at Texas A&M University, Corpus Christi. Larry McKinney, thank you very much for being here.
No problem, Tom. Good to talk to you.
And with us from New Bern, North Carolina, Larry Crowder is here. He's a marine biologist at Duke University's Marine Lab in Beaufort, North Carolina. Larry Crowder, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Larry McKinney, first to you, big picture. You heard right there the fisherman, you know, with the worry that we could be facing the Dead Sea. Give us your sort of overall sense of where we are in the Gulf. Is this a one-year turnaround, a 10-year turnaround, different periods for different forms of life, or do we have a permanent loss facing us here?
No, we're not facing the Dead Sea. The Gulf of Mexico is an amazing and a resilient body of water, particularly the northern Gulf, so we will come back, and I think you hit it on the head. It's going to be in stages. There will probably be some impacts on some shrimping and those types of things. They'll come back in a few years. We really don't know the extent of the damage on the wetlands. We hope it's far less than what some have anticipated, but until we can actually do the studies to measure that, we won't know that, but the restoration time, you know, in several years, five or so, something like that. Then you have some of the longer-lived marine life, like the turtles and dolphins and whales. Those are much longer, so that will come back over stages. We saw this in Ikthok, which was the previous oil spill of great size here, and it has come back and restored somewhat different, but it's come back. So, no, we're not going to see a Dead Sea out there, but it will be different. We just don't know how significantly different than it was before.
Larry Crowder, what's your sense of how long it might take to return the Gulf of Mexico to its condition before the Deepwater Horizon went down?
Well, the Gulf of Mexico is a sea that has natural oil seeps as part of it. We have experience with the Ikthok spill 30-some years ago, and the system did recover from that. I think Larry pretty much nailed it when he said that it's going to take time for the system to come back. I put it in years to decades. And recognizing that some of the longer-lived animals in particular, some of the endangered species, are really at risk because of this system and the magnitude of this effect. There's a strong contrast with the Prince William Sound example where the water is cold and the system, some would say, still hasn't recovered after 20-plus years. In the Gulf of Mexico, because of the warm water and the microbial activity, we may see a quicker return. But it's going to be a large effect, and it's going to go on for a long time.
How does Larry Crowder, how does that work, the microbial activity? Microbes go after elements in the oil. What do they go after? How quickly do they clean up what? And what are the consequences of that must be an explosion of that microbe population as well as they feast on this spill?
I guess the upside of the Gulf of Mexico is that there are microbes, there are bacteria that process small chains of petroleum hydrocarbons, so simple things like methane and some of the short chain of hydrocarbons, which are also the elements that are often most toxic to marine organisms. So that all sounds good, mm-hmm. except that the microbial populations in the process use oxygen. When they're respiring the oil, they use oxygen mm-hmm. in the process. And so there's some concern about deep oxygen depletion in the Gulf of Mexico. It's already home to one of the largest low oxygen so-called dead zones in the world that's driven by nutrient inputs from the Mississippi River drainage.
Fertilizer and runoff.
Now we have another source of a lot of organic material that the microbes can be working on.
Larry McKinney, what's your sense of the dead zone risk here? How big could that become? There's already a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. How much growth could we see in that?
Well, there's a big unknown here, and that is regards to what we're some concerned about, these underwater plumes, the oil that's far beneath the surface that some researchers have found, and we're trying to look at those now. And the biggest issue there, I think, with that is just as Larry was saying, is that this huge microbial activity will use up oxygen. So are we creating these large floating dead zones, which we hope are not the case? We're trying to find that out now. Mm-hmm. But it could extend our surface as well. So it's a big unknown issue that we really need to look at very carefully.
Let's get a call right here from Ian. He's calling from a research vessel off the east coast, off the coast of Connecticut, which I guess is headed down to the Gulf. Ian, where are you?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, we're about 25 miles off Connecticut right now, heading down to the Gulf of Mexico. It'll probably take us a couple more weeks to get there. We're actually taking samples from fish and whales as we head down in case the current brings these oil and synthetic contaminants up the coast. The expedition is co-sponsored by a group called the Ocean Alliance and the University of Southern Maine. And what's I got to say, what deeply worries me, Tom, is that the largest animal migration that happens on this planet actually happens every night when the benthic or deep water animals, you know, come from the down deep up to the surface of the ocean.
Right.
And we're now talking about these giant dead zones up there. And we also worry, could part of the cure in this case be actually worse than the disease? They've pumped in more than something like more than 1.5 million gallons of this chemical dispersant. So the one thing that's pretty cool about our boat is we have what's called a cell line laboratory in the aft cabin. So we will actually be biopsying sperm whales, probably Bridie's whales, orcas if we see them, humpback whales. We can then grow the cell line and then expose these living cells to stuff like Corexit 950, you know, the contaminant, even the water we find. And you can look at cell death that speaks to the immediacy of the exposure. But what's of greater concern is DNA damage. And I think, you know, if you really consider that the Gulf of Mexico is potentially the nursery for the Atlantic, you know, I think it's a real scary situation here.
Hang on, Ian. Larry Crowder, what about the risk of cell damage, genetic damage?
The use of Corexit and, you know, the toxic dispersants in a mile of seawater is uncharted territory for us. It's been long used to clean up the remnants of an oil spill at the surface. And even that's a trade-off because we know that this is toxic material. Pushing 2 million gallons injected at depth is really whole new territory. So elements of the petroleum itself are toxic, and we know that the Corexit can also be toxic in and of itself. When you mix those together, we really don't know. The caller is quite right to point out that there are many, many benthic marine organisms that vertically migrate into the water column. There are many, many organisms, invertebrates, and fishes that are spawning at this time of year that have microscopic larvae that are known to be highly vulnerable to the dispersants and also to some of these elements of the oil. This won't create film at 11, if you will, of dead larval fish on the beach. We'll never see those effects until we see basically holes in their population where they fail to show up 2 or 3 or 4 years from now.
Ian, you're out there on the sea headed down. How long are you going to be in the Gulf taking your samples and investigating?
Well, we've got funding right now for about 2.5-3 months. We'd like to be there for at least 6 months, and we'd like to return every year to make this a long-term study. I think one thing I need to point out about chemicals like Corexit, a lot of these chemicals are not water-soluble, but they are fat-soluble. So people think, well, how does this matter if I just dump a little bit into the Gulf of Mexico? Well, what happens is it dissolves into the sort of the phytoplankton, the carnivorous plankton, the small fish, and we call that bioconcentration. And then what happens is the next bigger fish eats the smaller fish, and you get what's called bioamplification up the food chain. So suddenly the species at the top of the food chain, like marine mammals, and actually maybe even some of the large fish we like to eat, have levels of these contaminants that have never been seen before in human history.
Ian, we're going to let you go there on the sea and wish you a good voyage to the Gulf of Mexico. Thank you very much for calling in. Larry McKinney, that's going to give people pause for some time, and with economic consequences, I suppose, about seafood from this area. I mean, when and how are people going to be confident that they can go back to that, I don't know, snapper or whatever they like from the Gulf?
Well, that's an important question. There's a lot of effort being driven toward detecting those types of issues. One of the things that we can be, you know, somewhat confident about is that bioaccumulation doesn't go all the way up, at least for the oils and those types of things, into the fish. The fish can process that oil and move it out of their system so they can get rid of it. The interesting question, of course, is our concern is correct and those types of things, and there's good debate about the potential impacts there.
Larry McKinney, hold that thought if you would. We've got more questions on dispersants there in Big Spring, Texas, and Larry Crowder in Northburn, North Carolina. Great to have you both with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the oil cap. Everybody's watching it in the Gulf of Mexico, whether it will stay on, should stay on. And we're looking at the biological fate of the Gulf and what comeback we can hope for. Larry McKinney joins us from Big Spring, Texas. He's director of the Heart Research Institute for Gulf of Mexico Studies at Texas A&M Corpus Christi. And from New Bern, North Carolina, Larry Crowder's here, marine biologist at Duke University's Marine Lab in Beaufort, North Carolina. We've got a question here online from Tim in Iowa. It says, I assume this has happened in the history of the Earth before, be it earthquakes or other geologic events. Massive amounts of oil surely were released into the ocean, writes Tim. I don't know. Do we have any history of those, he asks? How much comes out? How often? And he says himself he knows some were surprised by how quickly the environment recovered from the Ixtoc leak in, what, the late 1970s. What about the geologic record here? Larry Crowder, can we tell anything from distant history?
Well, the National Academy has done a number of studies to look at oil seeps, natural oil seeps around the world, and it turns out more oil enters the ocean from natural oil seeps than enters from oil spills, typically on an annual basis. What we have here is a little bit of a new situation in the sense that certainly there have been large oil spills before. There hasn't been a society, an economy, that's so dependent on a healthy ocean as we see in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, this is a situation where clearly environment and economics go together. If you talk to people who run tourism operations in Florida or to fishermen, recreational or commercial, the disaster is being visited upon them as much as it's being visited upon the fish and the turtles and so on. So I think that this is a pretty clear case where maybe the Earth in geological time has dealt with severe crises of this sort, but we also have built a society that's dependent on not having these sorts of crises, and our ability to cope is being pushed to the limits at the moment.
Well, let's talk about the marine society for a moment, and maybe sort of different classes or sizes of creature here. I don't know. Don, I mean, shrimping is famous in the Gulf. So if there's a problem now with the shrimp and, I don't know, die-offs, how long might it take for that to come back and be safe, Larry Crowder?
Well, one thing that the people may have noticed is that the National Marine Fisheries Service of NOAA has closed something like a third of the Gulf of Mexico to fishing.
Yeah.
So that they're doing their best to try to protect the seafood supply and reassure the consumers that those fish and shrimp that are exported are safe to eat. So that's being monitored very carefully.
But those that aren't, so, I mean, you know, after Ixtoc, I've read there was a 60 to 70% reduction in shrimp in the year of that spill in 79.
Right. I think that we can expect severe reductions in populations of a number of the targets of fisheries, both shrimp and crabs and fish populations. Some of the fish populations are critically endangered, like giant bluefin tuna, but still support an incredibly valuable fishery. Shrimp are fairly short-lived, so once there's some recovery of the water quality, the shrimp may come back over a 2 or 3 or 4 year period. For the longer-lived fish, for groupers and snappers and things that live to be decades old, if they have failed year classes as a result of this, that could persist for a period of time, again pushing years to decades. It's not terribly comforting to hear that 30 years after the Ixtoc spill, we pretty much can't notice its effects, because we have to get through those 30 years, and I think the people and the organisms in that system have a lot of recovery to undergo. We need to remember, even if the cap stays on, we have hundreds of millions of gallons of petroleum released all at once into this system.
Larry McKinney, what about the long-term here on these? I mean, we've got stressed species already in the Gulf of Mexico. Might we see extinctions as a result of this?
I think Larry did a very good summary. Just kind of repeat on the shrimp thing. And when we saw at Ixtoc, they did take a pretty good hit, but within a year to 2 years, they were back, and that's the good thing about the shrimp. When you talk about extinction type of things, I think probably some of the species at greatest risk is probably the gulf population of the bluefin tuna, just because they spawn in this very area and were spawning at that time, and they've already been tremendously overfished. So a species like that is at risk, and it will take us a year or so just to see what those impacts were.
And Larry Crowder is talking about maybe decades for dolphins, whale sharks, sea turtles to come back if they come back?
Oh, certainly. Those are because of their lifespan. That's probably what will happen. And then if you take it even further, go down into the depths to some of these chemosynthetic communities that are in the deeper water that could be affected by plumes, their lifespans are in hundreds of years. So it's a range of recovery. Like we said, in Ixtoc, we've seen it recover probably less than 30 years. I sent my biologist down to retrace some of their sampling stations down there just over the last week, and they still found oil mixed in some of the reef areas there that was from Ixtoc. So it's still there.
What about deep sea life, Larry Crowder? Will we ever even know? I'm not sure how good our awareness is at these great depths.
There's been a huge increase in exploration of the deep sea over the past 15 years, and some of the standard sites that deep sea biologists visit are in the Gulf of Mexico. So we'll know something about the sites at which we've done research before. What we won't know about are the sites that we haven't had an opportunity to visit. One important concern, and I've worked on research myself, mm-hmm. on the dead zone that's driven by nutrients and fertilizer and so on. That's usually in 30, 40, 50 meters of water. Now we're talking about high concentrations of methane and suppressed oxygen in 1,000 meters of water, 1,300 meters of water, mm-hmm. which is where these chemosensory systems operate. And there are a lot of benthic organisms that support productivity throughout the food web. And again, we're doing an experiment on a system at a very large scale, and we don't know what the full effects are going to be. For some populations that we monitor regularly, like in fisheries, we should be able to detect those effects over the next 4 or 5 years. One species we haven't discussed, Kemp's Ridley sea turtle, nests only in the Gulf of Mexico. That's the only mm-hmm. place in the entire world mm-hmm. Where the population carries on nesting. And that population has been subject to 20 years of intense effort to recover the population. It's up about tenfold from its low point, but no one has any idea what effect this spill will have. Their nesting beach isn't oiled, but all of the hatchlings and the adults migrate through the northern Gulf of Mexico at the end of the nesting season. So, and most of the turtles that have been found oiled are Kemp's Ridley turtles. If that species experiences a significant dent in the population, we'll at least be back to working very hard on recovery, and we could lose them. This is the only place that they nest in the world.
What's your sense of those hatchlings when they head out into the Gulf of Mexico for whatever their food source is there and hit this oil-fouled and dispersant-fouled water?
It's really a serious problem for both the hatchlings and the adults because their natural behavior is to leave the nesting beach in Mexico, which is a couple hundred miles south of the Texas border, and migrate in less than 100 feet of water around the northern Gulf of Mexico. They're attracted to lines of floating seaweed called sargassum, and those lines of floating seaweed are maintained at the surface by surface currents. This is exactly where the oil will also aggregate. So the behavior of the turtles will take them to these sargassum lines, which is also where the oil will aggregate, and they have to surface to breathe. So it really is just a conspiracy of factors which are likely to put the turtles exactly where the oil is in high concentration.
It sounds kind of grim for that species. What about the sea turtles that we're seeing eggs picked up from the beaches and FedExed off to the Atlantic coast? I mean, but yet these are turtles who go back to the same place every year to spawn. Can they survive, moved from the Gulf to the Atlantic?
I guess I'm not sure what to make of that effort. I think it's a heroic effort to try to save a few hundred sea turtle nests. They're mostly loggerhead sea turtles. Mm-hmm. They're being moved. The population in the northern Gulf is a unique genetic stock of loggerhead populations. So it's really important to try to protect and get as many hatchlings off those beaches as possible. The effect of rearing them out and releasing them on the east coast of Florida is uncertain. That is, will they find their way back 30 years from now when they return to nest? That's a question we don't know the answer to. And so I think what people are doing now is just a matter of faith, trying to produce as many turtles from that population as they can and hope for the best. But it's clearly a heroic activity with questionable benefits.
On faith. Let's go to Mark in Perth, Ontario, Canada. Mark, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. How
are
you doing
Hi.
Today? I'm calling about the gentleman who was talking about the biological oxygen demand within the water column.
Mm-hmm.
I've just had some experience with benthic macroinvertebrates in streams and rivers in the area where we are up here. And not that it's the same from an oil spill, but basically runoff from mining have caused like irreparable damage to macroinvertebrates, some of which have life cycles of up to 2 years, submerged. And I just wonder if that, the same effect is going to take place.
Mark, you're breaking up on us, but I think I've got the gist of it. Mark has seen the results of runoff, industrial and mining runoff further north. He's wondering about the dispersants and these. Now you're it's a little beyond me here, but the what macro invertebrates, benthic macro invertebrates. Larry Crowder, help us here. What about those? And what about the way these chemicals can collect, not just in the water, but also in the sands that ring the Gulf?
Yeah, I think that the issue that he raises, he called biological oxygen demand, basically is the requirement that benthic organisms have for oxygen to carry out respiration and metabolism.
And are benthic the ones that migrate up and down vertically in the water column?
The ones that are on the bottom. Mm-hmm. Benthic is a word that means they live on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them migrate off the bottom at night.
Mm-hmm.
But all sea organisms, with the exception of the air breathers, like the mammals and the turtles and the birds, depend on oxygen dissolved in the seawater. So when the microbes begin working on some 100,000 times more concentrated than background levels of methane that were recently discovered out there, the oxygen levels get suppressed. And what that does is suppress the metabolism, suppress the immune systems and so on of myriad organisms that are dependent on oxygen. The other issue with deep low oxygen in 1,000 meters of water or more is that it takes much longer for the atmosphere, for winds and so on, to mix oxygen to those depths.
Mm-hmm.
The dead zone in shallow water in the Gulf of Mexico goes away every season in the fall when the water temperatures moderate and the winds mix oxygen into the water column. Deep low oxygen down 1,000 meters or more could persist for quite a long period of time. And that low oxygen can influence the organisms that live on the sea floor. But at intervals, occasionally, that low oxygen deep water upwells in Mississippi Canyon, in DeSoto Canyon,
mm-hmm.
and can upwell low oxygen right up onto a shoreline.
Larry McKinney, what about the shorelines and wetlands there? What kind of consequences for how many years do you foresee?
Well, of course, we have to go back and assess that damage because we really don't know. There's been oil coming and going and hitting in different places and been a lot of speculation. So as soon as they can stop this oil, and hopefully they have done so, then we can go out and take those measurements. It will take us a season to see if we've just seen what we'd call a top kill, the top grasses and so forth have been killed off, or if it's root damage. If it's gotten down to the roots, then it's long-term, perhaps even permanent damage because once those roots go, the bottoms subside, and it won't reestablish there, and you go to open water and you lose the value of those wetlands. So we don't really know that yet. I think a lot of us have been concerned about extensive damage, but we're hearing some reports that perhaps it's not as bad as we thought. But nonetheless, recovery, we're talking in the terms of 2 to 5 to 6 years, that type of thing.
If you say it does recover. Spartanburg, South Carolina, William, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. I appreciate you holding this show. I'm very frustrated with the lack of research by the government and funding for independent scientists and access to close to the site of the spill. We need to get this critical information and capture it and understand exactly the impact that is going on to craft future legislation as it you know, relates to future oil policies and offshore drilling. You heard numerous times during the Senate hearings EPA and NOAA saying, we just don't know. And it's a critical moment in time to capture this information and study carefully the impact of the spill. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you very much, William. Larry Crowder, have you seen a break on research or inadequate resources put toward figuring out what's going on right now in the midst of this crisis?
I think the key issue that's really important is the long-term research to both understand the structure and function of the Gulf of Mexico ecosystem and to monitor its components. It's a bad time to start a research program after a catastrophe. It would have been much better to have solid research programs in place prior to the spill. So what's happening, in my view, is that there are people who had long-term research programs both in the agencies and in the universities who are trying to follow up on the after effects, having characterized what was going on before. There's also an armada of people going into that system trying to collect new data based on what's going on right now. The difficulty scientifically is you don't have before data to compare what you're observing with. And so there seems to be a lot of money going toward the problem at this point, and it would have been much better to have a better understanding of how these systems worked prior to the perturbation so that we could understand what the real effects are.
Larry McKinney, our time is very short. Larry Crowder uses the word catastrophe. There will be a battle to characterize what's happened here. Do you have any doubt that this is and will is an environmental catastrophe looking forward?
Oh, it absolutely is. It's the largest we've ever dealt with, and I hope we can bring the resources to bear that we have not brought in the past. As I said, the Gulf of Mexico has been long neglected in preparing these big studies, and we're reaping that reward now. Let's not do that again.
Larry McKinney at the Texas A&M Gulf of Mexico Studies Center in Corpus Christi, thanks for joining us. And Larry Crowder at Duke University, thank you to both of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.